Well, the first thing statehood has meant to Alaska, which is obvious, but most people forget it, is it's put two senators and a representative in the U.S. Congress. And most, if not all, of the problems that Alaska faced in territorial days came from the fact that it had no power within the Congress to get things done. So that is the first and foremost. People sometimes claim that we'd get nowhere in the Congress. But one thing is for sure, we get a whole lot more out of the Congress with two senators and a representative than we had with a voteless delegate.
And has statehood been basically good to Alaska other than from the political view?
Well, yes. Our entire economy is based on statehood because the Prudhoe Bay Reserve was a part of the lands which the state selected from the statehood entitlement that the federal government gave it in the Statehood Act. Though there have been delays in taking the entire amount of land that was granted to us, one of the first tracts which the state took from that statehood entitlement was what was now the Prudhoe Bay Reserve, which was not thought back then to be as valuable as it turned out to be in the early 60s. So our entire economy, the entire oil revenues of Prudhoe Bay, come directly from statehood.
Let's take another question on the political area. How has the rights of Alaskans or the rights of their control of their own future improved over having a statehood compared to the old territorial legislature?
Well, of course, the first thing you've got to remember is with the territorial legislature, the Congress of the United States had the power to overturn or veto anything the territorial legislature enacted. First and foremost, the state government or the local government now has the power to enact laws which can't be turned over unless they violate the Constitution of the United States. Thus that gives us, for example, the right to tax the oil companies. Unless those acts violate the Constitution or in some way, the U.S. Congress can't simply rescind those acts, which it could do under territorial legislation. Back when Alaska was a territory, it didn't even have the legal lawmaking powers that other territories had had. So as far as local rights, we've gotten the right to pass laws over our natural resources, which we didn't have completely in territorial days.
You mentioned natural resources. What are some of the ways we have more control now than we did?
Well, I think one example would be the limited entry in fishing. We had the right to establish a limited entry program, so that would be one example there.
Fireworks of January 3rd, 59, when they blew up the fish traps?
Oh, yes. And in fact, one of the principles on which we entered the Union was the abolition of the fish trap. And for those who don't know, the fish trap was a mechanical device which was very efficient at catching fish. It was used by the large canneries and the out-of-state companies to deplete the fishing resource. So ratification of the Alaska Constitution was tied to an ordinance to abolish the use of fish traps in Alaska. One of the reasons Alaskans wanted to cease being a territory and become a state was to abolish fish traps. And that was almost the first symbolic act of statehood, was the abolition of fish traps. Yeah, I wasn't here, so I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Economically, the state has benefited from oil, primarily oil from statehood. What other economic benefits have come to Alaska as a state, and what economic loss was there becoming a state?
Basically, there has not been any economic loss as a state. Alaskans paid in federal income taxes as a territory. And there were a lot of people who feared when Alaska became a state that there would be an economic loss because the people, or the taxpayers, would now have to fund the cost of state government. So a lot of people who voted against statehood feared an economic loss for that reason. But as things turned out, the oil revenues and other revenues which Alaska was able to take over as a state, which had formerly gone to the federal government, went into the state coffers. So I don't think any of us pay almost anything at the present moment for the expense of a state government. So to my knowledge, there really have been no economic losses. Of course, through having those congressmen in Washington, we were actually able to maintain a lot of things which people thought we would lose. For example, the military getting overseas pay for serving in Alaska is, as anyone can figure, obviously ludicrous. But this was a holdover from territorial days, and people feared when Alaska entered the Union that that economic benefit, the higher pay to servicemen, would vanish. But there are a lot of the leftovers from territorial days that were held into statehood specifically to benefit the new state. When Alaska came into the Union, there was a great desire in Washington amongst many members of the Congress that Alaska would work. And so a lot of seemingly archaic legislation has stayed on the books to prevent the kinds of economic losses Alaskans feared. It's interesting to point out, when Alaska entered the Union, the boosters did not envision that Alaska would develop the way it has today. Most of the boosters saw Alaska developing along the pattern of the lower 48 states, that it would have a diversified economy, that manufacturing would begin to develop to supply local needs, that the state would go toward more sufficiency in agriculture than it had in 59, that the road system would develop, and that essentially Alaska would follow a diversified pattern of development like the lower 48 states. Nothing of the sort has happened. I think it's interesting to look at maps and see that the road system that was projected in 1959, a road from Fairbanks to Nome, a road from Juneau to Anchorage, have not developed. The only roads of any consequence that have been added since statehood are the Parks Highway, paralleling the Alaska Railroad, and the Hall Road to the north. That road wasn't envisioned in 59. And then our economy has not developed on a diversified pattern. It's developed almost totally around the one resource of oil. We've become infinitely richer than anyone envisioned in 1959, but not by the pattern that they were thinking would develop. We're probably less self-sufficient as far as providing locally for local needs than we were in 59. If anyone watches the papers, dairies are going under in Alaska. Egg producing is going under. As we've become richer, we've also tended to import more and more of the basic necessities simply because they're cheaper.
There's enough market to make it worth someone else's wild country. Two somewhat loaded questions. The first one is going to be, what effect on Alaska's development have federal and state land legislation had?
Well, this is a difficult question to answer. There are many people who would say that federal land legislation has hampered Alaska's economic development because it's locked up mineral lands which could have been developed. On the other hand, everyone I've talked to mentioned that with the Prudhoe Bay field, that the resources up there were so rich that almost all forms of federal regulation were pushed through to get the Prudhoe Bay Prudhoe Bay Field online. So what has really happened is probably the federal legislation, which has made it difficult to develop lands, has slowed down a normal development of mineral resources. But when the resources are vast, no amount of regulation has really stood in our way.
Second question is, in Alaska, you mentioned that we voted on statehood. Isn't this unique among state entries?
Yes, it was. There had long been an attempt in the Congress to block Alaska statehood. And the Alaskans voted in their constitution in 56 and elected a so-called Tennessee Plan slate of legislators to go to Washington. So Alaskans had clearly opted for statehood at least 2 years before the Congress passed the legislation. Well, then when the Alaska statehood legislation went through in 58 what some people think as a last-gasp attempt by the anti-statehood forces, a clause was put in the statehood bill that Alaskans must then hold a referendum and vote in the statehood bill. Why anyone who was anti-statehood thought that that delaying tactic would work, I don't know, because it was quite clear Alaskans were for statehood. But yes, we were required to then officially accept this congressional bill after it had been passed in the summer of 58. So Alaskans had to vote again to accept the act of Congress. So that's why there was a 6-month delay between the statehood legislation being passed in Congress and the official proclamation that Alaska was a state in January of 59.
Did any other state ever vote on statehood like this?
At least one did, Texas. Texas was, of course, a separate republic, the Lone Star Republic, and it was annexed to the U.S. by a joint resolution of Congress in 1845, yes. And then the Texans had to vote to accept that joint resolution, so Texas had to.
Isn't part of the opposition in Congress to Alaska statehood, wasn't it based on partisan politics? Wasn't Alaska then primarily a democratic state?
Of course, some people said it was partisan politics, that Alaska was Democratic and the Congress was Republican and Eisenhower was Republican, but that wasn't really it. The opposition to Alaska statehood came from Democrats, from Southern Democrats, and the opposition was an anti-civil rights opposition. The Southern Bloc saw Alaska with its native population coming in as a state which would send two senators and a representative to Congress who would likely vote for civil rights legislation. So the major opposition to Alaska statehood came from Southern Democrats who saw Alaska as being another liberal state. No, they weren't mistaken. Alaska's congressional delegation was for civil rights legislation. Well, if by liberal you mean do you tax large corporations, then we are.
I've jumped around a bit, John. Is there anything I haven't asked that you would like to look? Anything that's triggered your something while we've talked? Where's the last going to go in the future?
Well, I think what we have to do is look at Alaska into the future the way it's developed in the past. And I mentioned earlier that economically, Alaska had not developed in precisely the pattern that others envisioned it. I would say, looking to the future, we can probably guess that Alaska will not develop in a way we can predict at the present moment. And the reason for this is that I don't think Alaskans will have much control over the pattern of development, that we're not going to become a manufacturing or an agricultural state or move toward a self-sufficiency that we could envision ourselves. It's not going to be because the Chamber of Commerce is going to be able to bring factories up here. We may be able to develop our tourism through our own efforts. But what is going to happen in the future, I think, is what's happened in the past, that the existence of certain large resources, certain natural settings or geographic locations, will become valuable in the eyes of people in the lower 48. And the capital will come from the lower 48 to develop those resources. And we won't have much control over which resource is chosen, because prices are set internationally, and the funds to develop them will be international. Much in the same way that, as much as we'd like to think we could build the gas pipeline ourselves, it's probably going to be developed, if it is, from outside. So what I would hope for the future is that Alaskans not get into a paranoid mentality that they don't have any control over their destiny, except the fact that the pattern of development may come from the outside, but then be as determined as our politicians have been for the last 25 years, which is to make sure that the prosperity that comes from that development remains for Alaskans in Alaska. And I think that's probably the best lesson we have from the oil resources. We're not ARCO and we're not Sahio. We didn't invent those companies. We didn't build the pipeline. Others did that for us. The oil is sold outside of Alaska, but we have been able, I think, more than any of the other oil-producing states, to tax that wealth so that those of us who live here benefit from what outsiders have done to us. And I think if we can do that in the future, we'll have a pretty good future. If we sit around wailing about the fact that we don't have total control over our destiny, I think we'll be less happy than we could be.